You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Jake Jacobson. This is the WFHB local news for Thursday, August 12th, 2021.
Later in the program, we have the latest edition of Prescription for Healthcare, a monthly segment dedicated to increasing the understanding of healthcare issues for the WFHB listening community through interviews and with commentary from medical and community experts. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB correspondent Emily McCoy provides a rundown of the latest in Indiana news and politics during our new segment, the State House Roundup. More following today's headlines. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is your local news brief for Thursday, August 12th. I'm Robert Robinson. The City of Bloomington has begun excavation work at Lower Cascades Park as part of their stream bank stabilization and trail construction project. This project will include installing new storm drains, road resurfacing, and refurbishing the stream bank walls. A new paved trail and boardwalk leading to the waterfall will also be installed. A tract of land along I-69 to the north of Bloomington that was up for annexation has been removed from consideration after pushback from residents and city council members. Residents, among other concerns, feared an increase in their property taxes, and some council members expressed skepticism about the viability of the land for development. Annexation will continue for other slated areas as the City of Bloomington seeks to keep its municipal services at pace with urban development. Monroe County's universal mask mandate remains in effect after being reinstated last week. Indiana University has also reinstated their universal mask mandate for the upcoming academic year, with the rate of vaccination among students and faculty currently at 85%. That's all for your Thursday news brief. For WFHB, I'm Robert Robinson.
On August 11th, the Bloomington City Council reconvened to continue its August 6th public hearing on annexation. Monroe County Commissioner Lee Jones talked about the county jail. She said the county would need financial support to make the changes necessary to reduce its prison population, and that annexation would take away a large chunk of those funds.
It will be necessary for the county to support these efforts, both financially and with personnel. ARPA may provide some of the funding necessary, but it wouldn't be wise to use that for personnel needs since it is a one-time fund. The county funds that will be most impacted by annexation are the funds that pay for operations and personnel, which will be needed for this effort with our jail.
Resident Pamela Tier Snyder showed concern over public safety. She wondered how an allegedly understaffed Bloomington Police Department could provide better service than what the Sheriff's Department already provides.
We like living in the county. We like our fire protection. We like our Sheriff's Department just fine. How are the police we have now, as everyone has already stated, who are short 40 officers, and I was told that years ago, so that's not something currently, who cannot cover what we already have, be able to cover an additional 6,000 more properties, 14,400 more residents, over 9,000 acres that spread from one corner of this county to the other.
Resident Kylene Crane commented on the economic effect of annexation. She said she opposes annexation because it may reduce funding for county schools and libraries.
And as an MCCSC teacher of 30 years, I am appalled that this annexation could reduce funding for our libraries and the school corporation.
Council members officially closed the public hearing. The City Council motioned to meet for a special session on August 31st for first readings and amendments for the annexation ordinances.
Monroe County commissioners talked about a new health order enforcement at their August 11th meeting. County Attorney Jeff Cockrell presented a contract with a security company to help enforce the county's emergency health order. He said the county would be hiring the same company they hired to help enforce the last coronavirus-related health order.
It is essentially the same agreement we had with Security Pro last year when we had we needed help with our health orders and their education and enforcement of them. This is the same hourly rate, same not to exceed $25,000. The end date for this is December 15th, 2021. So the hope is that we won't need them that long, but we'll have them for that period of time.
Bloomington Chamber of Commerce Representative Jim Shelton expressed support for the contract. He said having a company handle enforcement and education takes those burdens away from regular employees.
On behalf of the business community, we want to encourage you to approve this as we did at the work session. And thank you very much for providing this help to our businesses to deal with the education and enforcement part and let the employees do their jobs.
Commissioners ratified the contract unanimously.
The Monroe County Stormwater Management Board considered additional funding for the Lake Monroe Water Fund. At the August 11th meeting, Lake Monroe Water Fund Chairperson Jane Martin addressed concerns that LMWF may be taking funds away from other Lake Monroe groups. She said her organization acts as a funding gap for organizations like Friends of Lake Monroe.
I believe we fill an important funding gap in our environmental ecosystem, and in fact, will provide critical funding to existing organizations.
Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System Coordinator Kelsey Thetania showed hesitancy funding staff positions for non-county organizations. She said the Stormwater Board should focus on funding the maintenance and operation of Monroe County's storm sewer system.
What I see is that the goal of the stormwater utility and the fee that we charge our residents and other property owners, it's for the maintenance and operation of the storm sewer system. And funding a outside staff position that will be for fundraising, it just seems a little bit beyond what our mission is.
County Surveyor Tron Enright Randolph suggested the board table the request until a 2022 meeting. He said this would give the board time to figure out how things like the ongoing watershed study will affect this decision in the future.
If we were able to table it into 6 months from now or something, that shows our willingness to continue this discussion, shows that we are semi-supportive, but we're just not in a good place or point in time to finish this. One statement I made last month is, I feel like we need to finish our first project before we take on another project. So we might even be getting, some preliminary feedback of what that conclusive watershed study is going to be looking like.
Board members voted to table the request until their March 2022 meeting, 3-1, with Commissioner Penny Githens dissenting.
Up next, WFHB correspondent Tilly Robinson provides an update on rising COVID-19 numbers across the state and in Monroe County. We turn to Robinson for more.
COVID-19 cases in Monroe County are still rising. Data from the New York Times reported Wednesday shows Monroe County's 7-day average case count at 24 new COVID-19 cases each day. That represents a 53% increase in cases over the past 2 weeks. The state of Indiana's 7-day average for COVID-19 cases had increased to nearly 2,000 cases yesterday, which is a 143% increase over the past 2 weeks. In response to the uptick, local health officials have reinstated a mask mandate. All Monroe County residents are required to wear face coverings in indoor public spaces. The order went into effect last Thursday and is expected to stay in place until at least September 30th. The Monroe County Board of Health met again on Monday. Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill said that an array of precautions continue to be necessary.
I do believe that if we can get people to continue to vaccinate, mask, practice all the various layers of prevention, use every tool that we have in our toolbox, that we can curb this. But the Delta variant is definitely much easier to spread. That's really what seems to be what we're seeing in Indiana the most.
Indiana University is also once again requiring masks inside campus buildings. Area school districts have responded to the rise in COVID-19 numbers as well. On July 27th, the Board of the Monroe County Community School Corporation approved changes to this year's reentry plan.
All those in favor of the motion to approve the reentry plan adjustment as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
In the adjusted plan, MCCSC announced that students and unvaccinated staff will be required to wear masks in school buildings. The Richland Bean Blossom School District had previously planned to make masking optional. But in an email last week, RBB Superintendent Jerry Sanders announced that masks would be required for all students and staff. So far, only one Monroe County school, Seven Oaks Classical School, has announced that it plans to violate the county mask mandate. The Ellettsville Charter School will not require masks nor encourage vaccinations. The most recent COVID-19 update from the Indiana State Department of Health was live-streamed on July 30th. State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box said that guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now encourages masking indoors once again.
This week, the CDC issued new guidance recommending that everyone age 2 and older wear a mask in public indoor settings in areas with substantial or high transmission of COVID-19, even if they're fully vaccinated. The Indiana Department of Health is strongly urging Hoosiers to follow this guidance. This also applies to students, staff, and teachers in our K-12 schools, regardless of the level of community spread.
Dr. Box also said that individuals who are close contacts of someone with COVID-19 should get tested, regardless of their vaccination status. She emphasized the increased risk posed by the Delta variant of the coronavirus.
The biggest threat is from the Delta variant, which is fueling our current increase in cases. This variant, which was first identified in India, spreads more than twice as easily from one person to another compared with other strains. The CDC has compared the infectivity of the Delta variant to that of the chickenpox and measles, which means that each infected person can infect an average of 8 or 9 other people.
The Delta variant now accounts for almost 83% of COVID-19 tests sequenced in Indiana. Indiana Chief Medical Officer Dr. Lindsay Weaver explained that although vaccines are not perfect, they are still a vital tool in fighting the coronavirus.
I want to stress that breakthrough infections for vaccinated people are still very low and tend to be mild. But we are finding that they are more likely with the Delta variant than they are with any of the other strains that we have seen. No vaccine is 100%. We hear every year from people who have received the flu vaccine but still get the flu. But vaccines do prevent many cases of illness and are especially effective at preventing hospitalizations and deaths.
Dr. Box also highlighted the importance of widespread vaccination.
Until we increase our vaccination rates, and unless we use every tool available to us to stop the spread of disease, this virus will continue to have the advantage. It will continue to mutate, and we will be constantly playing whack-a-mole for the foreseeable future. I personally do not want to play games with Hoosiers' lives.
As of Monday's Monroe County Board of Health meeting, the vaccination rate in Monroe County was 57.5% of eligible residents. For more vaccine information, visit ourshot.in.gov. To register for a free COVID-19 test, visit coronavirus.in.gov and navigate to the testing information page. The Indiana Department of Health will livestream its next COVID-19 update tomorrow on YouTube. For WFHB, I'm Tilly Robinson.
Now it's time for the State House Roundup, a short rundown of Indiana news and politics at the state level. WFHB correspondent Emily McCoy has more.
From WFHB, this is the State House Roundup for Thursday, August 12, 2021. I'm Emily McCoy. This week on Monday, Governor Eric Holcomb signed the House Enrolled Act of 1384, an educational law that will require all students in Indiana public middle schools to complete at least one semester of civics education. The law was initially proposed by State Representative Tony Cook. In a statement, Cook said, quote, "Young adults are not always armed with the tools and knowledge to successfully participate in our democracy," end quote. Representative Cook commented that the concept of this law was initially recognized by the Civics Education Task Force, which is led by Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. Currently, before graduating from an Indiana public school, seniors are required to take one course in government. On Tuesday, the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, or the IBLC, approached Attorney General Todd Rokita on the legality and bias surrounding the announced Parental Bill of Rights back in late June of this year. The Parental Bill of Rights is an outline for parents of students attending Indiana public schools of their rights in accordance with Indiana law. The Parental Bill of Rights outlines the ways in which parents can attend meetings and question or review what their student is being taught within the classroom. However, the IBLC is concerned that because the state of Indiana doesn't currently have a law in effect that requires Indiana public schools to educate students on critical race theory, Indiana public schools could refrain from teaching students about race and its history. The IBLC commented, quote, "We encourage the Attorney General and our fellow state officials to simply let our teachers teach," end quote. The IBLC announced that it is looking forward to working further on its mission to present a more effective and inclusive cultural education system in the Indiana public school system next year during the legislative session. That's all for the State House Roundup. For WFHB News, I'm Emily McCoy.
Now it's time for Prescription for Healthcare, a monthly segment dedicated to increasing the understanding of healthcare issues for the WFHB listening community through interviews and with commentary from medical experts and community experts. In today's episode, we hear from Aaron Bauman, a four-year medical student at Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Prescription for Healthcare airs on the second Thursday of each month on the WFHB Local News. It's available online and wherever you find your podcasts.
From Bloomington, Indiana, welcome to Prescription for Healthcare on WFHB Community Radio, Bloomington, Indiana, sponsored by Medicare for All Indiana. I'm Karen Greenstone, along with Dr. Rob Stone. Our guest today is Aaron Bauman, a fourth-year medical student at Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. She was the driving force behind the Bloomington Campus Group Students for a National Health Program, or SNAP. Before medical school, Aaron, who is bilingual in Spanish, worked at the Volunteers in Medicine Clinic in Bloomington. She's preparing to apply for internal medicine residency programs with an interest in primary care and Geriatrics. Welcome to Prescription for Healthcare.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Erin, how did you become interested in Medicare for All?
I think there are multiple things that contributed to that over time, but it really started for me when I was volunteering at Volunteers in Medicine in Bloomington, helping care for uninsured residents of Monroe and Owen counties in Indiana. And I just saw the extent to which people from a varying set of backgrounds would come through without insurance, and hearing their stories about what they went through and sometimes how they lost their insurance even, and how they were locked out for months and unable to access the care that they needed, the medicines that they needed routinely, was really striking to me. I grew up in a pretty privileged setting of a middle-class family, went to university, so I hadn't faced that battle myself, and I wasn't really exposed to that as much. So that was a pretty eye-opening experience, just seeing how people who had Healthy Indiana Plan at the time were coming through saying, oh, I moved, missed a bill, and now I don't have health insurance, and they won't give it to me for 6 months. I was just so struck by that, and it left enough of an impact on me that I started exploring the topic and kind of what movements and options were out there for connecting people who don't have insurance to have insurance, and maybe what we could do better as a society, as a country. And I met Dr. Rob Stone, who was volunteering at Volunteers in Medicine, and had some conversations, found out about the Medicare for All Indiana group in Bloomington, and started attending those meetings. And then the interest really grew.
Erin, how receptive do you think medical students in Indiana are to the idea of Medicare for All, a national program?
I think the concept of Medicare for All or a single payer health program, single payer health insurance, there are many terms for the same thing. I think the concept is pretty familiar to a lot of medical students in my class at my year. So I'm going to be the graduating class of 2022. And when I was thinking about starting Students for a National Health Program at IUSM, opening a chapter there, I had from conversations briefly, I knew that there would be some degree of interest, but I didn't know how strong it would be. And I think I was fortunate in being in a fairly open-minded community, Bloomington, Indiana. So a lot of the students that were attracted to that program specifically may have been biased towards having an open mind or having these progressive thoughts. But when I started formally talking to people about interests and what do they think about just even as a student group, discussing the idea of what health insurance options we could have, not just advocating for Medicare for All, but just having discussions more often since it's not part of the curriculum. And people were really excited about it. And medical students were incredibly grateful, honestly, to have an opportunity to learn more about the healthcare system and to explore the issues and the barriers that providers face trying to provide care and that patients face receiving care or accessing care. I think med students really see that as a deficiency in a lot of curriculum and in our training or kind of our academic exposure. So starting a student group was easy in that respect. And people were very supportive of the idea of Medicare for All. I think a good portion of the initial 15 to 20 students that came out to the call out were on the fence. And just because it was a new concept to them, but pretty shortly after just hearing an introduction on how there are around 30 million people who are uninsured, how making them also aware that people in Indiana, for example, have health insurance through HIP, our expanded Medicaid, but then even within that can get dropped and locked out. Just exposing students to those issues more in a situation where they weren't previously aware, I think push them more to be open to the idea of single payer or Medicare for All, even if they were from a more conservative background or traditional background where they didn't previously think about that as an option.
Will you talk about SNAP as a national movement? Because we, Rob and I, see you and students like you, student activists, that you are the future. What do you see from your experience communicating with other groups and with your student group?
Building off of what we just talked about, from a student interest level, the first year we just started in Bloomington, but even by the next year, when we were at Student Involvement Fair, kind of introducing newer medical students to the different student organizations that they could get involved with, we had a lot of interest from other campuses, and especially from Indy, since it's Indianapolis is the main medical school campus.
Just talking about the national movement.
Yes.
Have you gone to some of the national conventions?
I haven't been to one. The most recent one this year was in April, and it was virtual since we have the COVID-19 pandemic that we're dealing with. I didn't go to that one, and I hadn't been to the one the year before, but we did have a lot of students in the year below me attend that one. And they had a really good time brainstorming with other student chapters about things that we could bring to Indiana, and also just how to have these conversations in an effective way among students and then also with legislators. I went to the national meeting in 2000, and it would have been 18 or 19. And that was in New York, and it was very exciting to be a part of it. I was mainly there in the role of someone starting a new chapter and trying to learn about how other chapters function and how we could mimic the successful chapters that were already out there. But I think what was most surprising was it seemed like we were doing most things right, which was a good sign. And a lot of students in more blue states, for lack of a better term, were doing incredibly progressive and very strong, like making strong statements with their events and with their actions, doing things like die-ins, making sure that they went specifically to whether it was law enforcement or political figures in their area and making their voices heard as a medical student community, that people were doing a whole spectrum of actions that I think were really inspiring for me. And also it just shows how much interest there is for medical students to make these changes happen and how passionate a lot of people feel who are going into the medical field about us needing to do a better job as a country and as medical professionals of providing access to healthcare for people and making sure that the money that's being put into healthcare is being used wisely. And a lot of that discussion is about the wasted money and overhead right now. I think people are really excited about how we could redistribute that money to better serve our patients. And that's something that medical students have shown in a lot of different ways at that conference and outside of that conference.
For our listeners, could you explain what a die-in is?
It's actually not something I've participated in, and I have a limited understanding. My understanding is that people who are participating in a die-in will lay on the ground. Maybe they'll have signs. Maybe they'll have something that is part of their message that they're trying to convey to a broader audience, but usually to a political figure about needing to make a change. Die-in could be if you wanted your state legislator to act on a bill, or if you were against their approval of a certain bill that just went through, you may go to their office and with a group of people. And instead of protesting and yelling, you're really just laying down on the ground to demonstrate the damage that behavior or that decision could bring with it in a very visual way.
It's like going beyond a sit-in.
There was one on the courthouse lawn here a couple of years ago. Okay, Aaron, what is your prescription for healthcare?
I really do believe that a single publicly funded, privately delivered universal healthcare system is the best option for us as a country. I think it does the best. That structure really allows for people to live in more comfort and safety, that they know that healthcare is going to be available to them. And I think right now people lack that. Even people with health insurance don't feel like it's reliable. And it's not because of the quality of care that's often delivered, but rather the financial consequences that may come along with the bill that they're going to receive, or not knowing how much all these services are going to cost, and just feeling like things are happening to them and they have no control over it, and yet they're going to have to pay for it. So I think having a universal healthcare system or universal health of some kind really would allow people to feel better cared for.
So do you have any last thoughts that you would like to share?
So I think what the main message that I like to leave with people is to always think critically about the system that we're in and how it can be better, and to not settle for when we think we accept struggles or what we might even view as like mistreatment or things that aren't right just because it's the way it is. I think it's really important to always be questioning that. And just because something functions a certain way doesn't mean it can't change. I think that's how humans have progressed for years, is we do change things. So just keeping that in mind, trying to facilitate these conversations, wherever you stand on them, like I would encourage people to talk about it. Talk about it with your healthcare provider, talk about it with your family and your friends, and see how we could all do better. So I would just encourage those conversations. And of course, if you haven't explored the option of single payer Medicare for all, it's a quick Google search and you can learn a lot very quickly.
Aaron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For talking with us today. I know you're very busy and we appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
For Prescription for Healthcare, this is Karen Greenstone and Dr. Rob Stone on WFHB Community Radio, sponsored by Medicare for All Indiana. Until next time, to your good health, everyone.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Robert Robinson, Emily McCoy, Tilly Robinson, and Jake Jacobson in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Dr. Rob Stone and Karen Greenstone.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. The engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast online at WFHB.org.
You can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Big Talk for a conversation with Dave Askins of the B-Square Bulletin. Coming up next on WFHB.